is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal here in the seat with my ever-genial co-host Eagle One of Eagle Speak, and we really appreciate you joining us today, whether you're live or with us on the archive. And if you are with us live, I'd like to invite you to go ahead and scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you'll find the chat room where you can come in with the usual suspects. We've already got a half dozen there. And if you have some observations you'd like to make during the course of the show, or especially today, if you have some questions you would like for Eagle One and I to address, or a topic you would like for us to discuss, this is more than usual the time to do it, because this is a February free-for-all. We have no guests. It's just Eagle One and I sitting here on the microphone pontificating as we are wont to do. And if you are feeling extra extemporaneous and talkative, this is also a great time to give us a call. You can call the switchboard directly at 347-308-8397. And if you didn't write that down, right at the top of the show page, you can read it yourself. Please call in. We'd love to hear it straight from the guest's mouth, so to speak. And if you got to leave halfway through the show and you want to see how our tap dancing went, you can always get the archive over at Blog Talk Radio, or take the shortcut and get the free podcast over on iTunes or Stitcher. And this is the point that we usually bring our guest on, but hey, Eagle One, it's just you and me today. Good afternoon.
Hey, Sal, how you doing today?
I am in better shape than I really, really should be. As those that follow me on Twitter know that I spent some time out in California this week, and if I had two people tell me I had 200 going, it's never been this green before. It rained. It's been brown for years. I was like, well, I brought the green with me. So everybody in California, you treated me well, and I didn't catch the flu, which looks like one-third of my kids' school has the flu, so we'll all survive that. Enough of California. It's very expensive there. But let's talk a little bit, if we wanted to kick things off. Something I chewed on this week is, in a very, very big pixel way, talk a little bit about leadership. Not usually how we've talked about it on Midrats, at the unit level or even the service level leadership, but even a little bit bigger than that, is when you look at ways of approaching leadership. There's one way of doing it, which is you tell people, countries, organizations, whatever, what they want to hear, what makes you feel good saying, or what makes them feel good hearing, regardless of what the actual facts are, just so they'll say nice things about you and you get nice press releases and everybody, you know, hugs, kisses, grabs a coffee and donut and goes back home after submitting their travel claim. Another way of doing it is if you really have friends and you really have teammates, a leader of a team, successful teams will usually tell their team members what they expect of them and then follow through with rewards or rebukes. And there are good ways and bad ways of doing it, but I thought of that because since the unlikely election of Donald Trump to president, there's been a lot of international pushback against him and his style, and especially some of the things that he'd said about NATO and our allies, a subject that you and I have talked about with our guests over the course of the last 7 years, and that's, you know, fair share contribution. And Angela Merkel, who has a rather tough election coming up, had been one of the people that really pushed back against him the most. Germany spends 1.2% of their GDP on defense, and it's quite a jump for them to get up to 2%. But she even came out this weekend and said Germany has to reach the NATO goal of 2%. And it's interesting that I wonder if some of it has been the transition of Donald Trump being the commander chief, but looking at the people that we have as our Secretary of Defense, now at the National Security Advisor, maybe the heft in the back channel communications is laying out. So one thing I'm just curious to get your perspective on, Eagle One, is how much do you think that we can really give a nod to the tone of the new administration, or how much of this might be driven internally by a slow sobering up to a resurgent Russia, which is right across the border?
Oh, I think it's a little of both. I mean, I think that the previous attitude was the U.S. would rush to protect its NATO allies no matter what. I think Mr. Trump set up a nice, what's the right word, negotiating position by saying, oh, maybe we ought to rethink NATO. And I think that might have, you know, twitched a lot of eyebrows in the European community. And then, you know, when it became apparent that what he's really talking about is you've got to start carrying your load. And then Mattis saying the same thing, you know, which is the duty to protect your children does not fall on us. It's your responsibility. And I think that plays well even in European election politics. And I think that may account for some of the shift in Merkel's position.
Yeah, I think that's about spot on. I think what, for a variety of internal reasons, for those that enjoy pain enough to follow German internal politics, that it's going to be a tough spot for NATO if Merkel doesn't get her fourth term in office, because her opponent in the SPD, who is most likely, if Merkel can't form a government, to be asked to form the government, he's not going to increase defense spending in any way, shape, or form. And if anybody is familiar or has so much time on their hands that they've watched some of the exchanges in the European Parliament between him and Nigel Farage, the fact that our commander-in-chief is a close associate of Nigel Farage does not bode well for future U.S.-German relations if the SPD comes to power. So I was originally, in 2017, really interested in watching the results of the French election coming up. And, of course, those that know me know that I'm all about the Dutch. So the Dutch have a very significant election coming up. But, hey, let's throw the Germans in there as well, because we could come off at the tail end of 2017. And at least one of those is going to have a big shock and surprise, one of those elections. I think having the SPD lead in Germany would be a much larger shock at this day and time than having a constitutional crisis in the Netherlands, because the party that gets the most, Geert Wilders' party, is not allowed to form a government, or the socialists were able to snatch it in the second round from the National Front in France. So I'm kind of shifting my eyes to the German election to see whether they're going to be able to get the SPD out of power again, and maybe Merkel can give another run, because you talk about reinforcing Europe. If Germany can pump it up to 2, Britain's already nibbling 2. I think France is about 1.7. Poland's already at 2 and it's going to go further north. Estonia's at 2. The other Baltics will be at 2 soon. That if Germany steps forward like that, I think, regardless of the reason, and I don't care who you give credit to, having our European allies reach that 2% level, I think, sends the right message to Russia, because Russia understands strength. And a strong Europe, even just stronger looking on paper, I think would do more for peace in at least that region of the world than any type of defense increases we could do here. So I am optimistic and hopeful that our European allies will rise to the challenge and strengthen themselves for their own good more than anything having to do internally here. But more often than not, if they're strong, the entire West is strong.
Yeah, I think that's true. Among the other things that I thought we ought to talk about today was had more to do with the Middle East, which of course is always a fun topic of conversation for us. And this involves the recent attacks on shipping off the in the Red Sea and in the Bab al-Mandeb, or as you call it, the Barbara Mandel. You know, you got to be a certain age to even know who that is. But we've seen some interesting weapons out there recently. What may have been some version of a C-802 or whatever that was, and now this what apparently was some kind of drone vessel attack on the Saudi frigate. And despite the fact that some of the weapons involved seem to be of Iranian, and then if you trace them back, Chinese origin, I'm really curious about this drone boat and wondering if there's not a North Korean hand in there somewhere. They're big on these semi-submersible or largely submersible type vessels, and I'm not sure what the difference is between a drone boat and a torpedo, but maybe the drone boat is you know, capable of more directional steering than a torpedo, but unless you're using wire guided or something. So anyway, what do you think about those events off that Yemeni coast?
Well, I think as we see in this line of work that, and who knows when our next major war will be. Well, it may be in a month, it might be in a year, it might be in a decade, it might be in 50 years, who knows. But it's going to come eventually. And little conflicts and little incidents in other people's wars in between give you insight on things you ought to be looking at. And I like what you said about, if a drone boat is a torpedo. A torpedo is, in a way, a drone. Whether it's wire guided or whether it has programming, which the kids nowadays like to call AI, but a seeker head on a torpedo is its own type of AI. It all depends about where you want to draw the line between programming, sensors, and AI. But there is a coming together of technology in a variety of different ways that needs to have people step back and think about what is going on here. Whether it's GPS, but even if you jam that, there's inertial guidance systems and other navigation systems that are incredibly accurate and programmable and cheap. And it's one thing to attack a Saudi frigate out there in the Red Sea. But it doesn't take too much to take that drone speedboat technology and move that to the tidewater of Virginia, move that to San Diego, move that to Groton. How much warning time do you have between what looks like a bunch of guys and a 22-foot Sea Fox going out fishing for striped bass, throttling up, and off they go? I think going inshore, if you want to get away from, you know, use inside CONUS for a variety of nefarious purposes, it's that whole discussion about swarm attacks, whether the swarm attacks are a bunch of guys sitting in there or if you have a half dozen to 10 remote-controlled or otherwise controlled service boats that are coming at you like a torpedo, just like you said. How do you defend against that? I would argue that when you look at the top side of many of our warships, it has the same affliction that we're seeing on ships before World War II, we're seeing before the Falkland Islands War, is they were designed and manned and weaponeered based upon certain assumptions and criteria, part of which is to save money in peacetime. And you always have to plus up when war actually comes, especially when it comes in, whether that's a low-flying A4 coming at you with cannon fire you never expected to see when you were designing your frigate, to a half dozen speedboats coming at you. And that's a bunch of medium caliber weapons, probably manserved, crew served, or at least remote with the option of being crew served. Because the last thing you want is to get hit by one of those, get dropped offline, and then you have no ability to defend yourself in the second, the third, the fourth, and the fifth. So hopefully what this is a wake-up call for us to have an honest discussion about our ships and the ships our allies have. Do we have enough defense in depth to be able to address that? Because I think we're going to see it more and more. They saw what the Cole did. They didn't sink the Saudi ship, but that's not for want of trying. It's a wake-up call. Hopefully we're paying attention to it.
Yeah, I would hope so. I mean, the Office of Naval Research has had a whole bunch of videos up about with these remote swarms of remotely driven swarms of small boats, mostly carrying some kind of automatic weapon system, not laden with tons of explosive or even 100 pounds of explosive. But, I don't think it's aside from the computer issue, the programming issue, I don't think it's a problem that anybody else could not solve fairly quickly if they can learn to deal with those issues. And, as we all know, the Iranians have had these wing and ground small things that they've been bragging on for years, plus, and they have a number of those apparently, and then they have shown during some of their exercises North Korean designed semi-submersible boat of some kind that seems to be fairly high speed. So, it's not like it's unknown in the area and that other people can't emulate that. And if just like with the Russians in Syria and some of these other wars, it's a great place to test out your weapon systems, and especially against people who may not be fully awake to the dangers that are out there. And unless you start building, anti-torpedo blisters on your ships again, I'm not quite sure how we're, there are a number of ways to defend and this, as you say, but it does, that last line of defense is always the one that worries you. Speaking of North Korea, though, one of the other topics of some interest has been their recent test firing of a missile, I'm not sure these things are connected, but then the assassination of the current Kim's brother. So what do you see is going on in North Korea, and is it they're just demanding attention, or is it time to once again be quite concerned about what the crazy people in charge there will could conceivably do, or is this another one of these blackmail attempts?
One thing I have to always remind myself is I don't think anybody really can get their head around what the North Koreans are really doing, what the North Koreans are really focused on or motivated by, because the Hermit Kingdom has been so detached from any other global context, reference point, etc., than any other nation around. It's hard to see a more intellectual, cultural, moral, or ethical isolation experiment than North Korea. So we can try to understand why something was going on, but I think we need to be careful and maybe need to back up. I mean, back up really far. We are all human beings. We all have roughly the same brainstem and instincts. And when I was trying to figure out what was going on, I went through the usual knee-jerk reactions, and I realized that that's probably 100% wrong. I said, so let's go back in the brainstem. Let's go back in history. Let's go back to more base motivations. Hermit kingdoms tend to be paranoid. Supreme rulers tend to be extremely paranoid. When you have isolated, extreme rulers with absolute power who have gotten their position by birthright, one thing that history shows us is that immediate threat isn't so much their military, though it is considered a threat, but if you control it right, you're okay. The threat is from your own family and somebody else who either might have a claim to your power or can be used by other people as a figurehead to grab your power. And whatever is going on Mr. Old Style Telephone Set Haircut Kim, if I had to put a paycheck on it, I was saying he wanted to eliminate his half-brother, simply for the fact that he was his half-brother. But what scares the bejesus out of me is the fact they used VX. That's like taking care of, it would be as if all of a sudden to take care of illegal fishermen off of the Chinese coast, the Chinese decided just to nuke them. What reference point do you come in spraying VX gas? Not VX gas, actually liquefied, which is interesting. I'm going to show a little ankle here. I do actually listen to National Public Radio on occasion, and they had a guest on NPR who is a CBR expert, whatever that is, and he made a good point about VX. VX gas is one thing, but VX in a liquid form is actually a very effective assassination tool. Because unless that pellet of liquid actually gets on you or in you, you're safe. It doesn't vaporize. It's not going to, if you spray it in somebody's face, it's not going to kill everybody in the room. It's only going to kill the people it touches. But if they're going to use VX as an assassination tool for reasons having to do with heredity and keeping power, what else might they use it for? Who else might they give it to? And are we ready to respond to it? Remember in the early 90s that goofball cult did a VX attack in the Tokyo subways that didn't actually do that much. But that's another one of those little hints there. We could all come up with five or six different scenarios of how you could really do some damage with something like that. You there? You going?
Yes, I keep pushing this wrong button.
That's my story.
It definitely shows that the Norks have weapons of mass destruction in addition to their nukes. And, if they decide to, it's so brazen, the attack was so brazen. I just wonder how brazen they would be if they decided they really wanted to do some stuff other places where they haven't yet gone. And, the other thing, there's a lot of stuff going on with North Korea that doesn't get much press. I mean, they run a huge illegal operation in drugs and a bunch of other areas. It's all over the world. It's not just in counterfeiting. There's a whole bunch of stuff going on. They are not a nice nation, no matter how you cut it. And I can see them reaching out, perhaps, to other people they don't like in the same way. And, that I find that kind of concerning that they would be so callous in the use of a pretty dangerous chemical weapon.
And I think you hit on something very important here, is when you rack and stack possible red COAs in the Korean Peninsula, maybe the use of chemical weapons or nuclear weapons in initial strike, if for whatever internal reasons they decide they want to take back the Korean Peninsula, if that was, worst case scenario for Red, what if that's most likely? What if of possible courses of action, you have that ranked number 6? Do you need to now rank that number 2? Because if they're going to use VX to take out somebody's half-brother for dynastic purposes at an airport, it's not much of a stretch for them to say, okay, it's now time for us to take back the entire peninsula. Let's nuke Seoul. Soak everything 50 miles deep with gas coming out of artillery, which is pretty straightforward to do, and we'll go from there. What's our reaction to that? Or what if they just do gas and they don't do nuke? That is an interesting scenario that I know I'm not ready to get my head around, but I don't think it's something anybody should laugh at as being off the table.
Yeah, I absolutely agree, which is, the whole situation out in that part of the world is getting so unusually different than it has been. I mean, with China coming back from its 100 years of, what they refer to as 100 years of embarrassment where, they were basically controlled for a long time by the Brits and everybody else that exerted power over them, and humiliation, 100 years of humiliation. We see that playing out in the South China Sea, I think, probably more than anything else. Plus there, let's talk a little bit about the South China Sea. The freedom of navigation issues as opposed to innocent passage. Are we doing the right things out there? We have a carrier, as I understand it, we're operating in the South China Sea right now. Should we be worried about the Chinese attempting to establish an air defense intercept zone? Where do you see this mess headed to?
Well, I see the Chinese doing something actually kind of smart here. I think China will show a capability to do a lot, but will be de-escalatory in posture. They will take two steps forward and will be glad to take 1.8 steps back as long as they net 0.2. They'll wait a while. They'll take another two steps forward. They'll be glad to take a step back as long as they are in a net positive. I think they're doing the real long game here, where they're going to make it common. They're going to make it standard. Every time we compromise or step back, they will mark that line with indelible ink and say, well, it's been established practice for X number of years. This is what it is. What are you going to do about it? It's easy to look at these little islands and their SAM missile sites and everything else and, go tactical in your head and go, well, that's a pretty easy TLAM target. Give me an SSGN. I'll take it out over there. That's not what's going on here. They can look like they can do a lot, which they could if they wanted to, but they really just want to see how much they can take by standard practice. Who's going to stand up to them? I think the friendly relationships they've got going on with the Philippines now was a little jewel dropped in their lap. Maybe they were working that. I'm a little more Oxum's razor about it. I just think they got lucky and they're taking advantage of a leader in the Philippines that can give them a chance to move things a little faster than they wanted to for whatever reason. I think China is just going to play the long game here and let elections in the West do what they want to do, and they'll just let the facts on the ground speak for themselves. Same thing with in the chat room, a couple of folks were asking about what's China's long-term view of going to sea. I think Claude brought up their 25th anti-piracy flotilla. I think again the Russians, the Chinese are being real smart about this. They're taking their time. They're learning. They're progressing forward. I think they're being very deliberate about it. They're being very Chinese about it. And they're doing what we would do if we were a rising power. Perhaps they're being a little more cautious than we would be, but who knows. I think that we should expect more. You're going to see more Chinese bases. You're going to see more Chinese deployments. You're going to see more Chinese capabilities. And I know one thing that we've tried to do here on this show, at least, is to raise the topic on a regular basis. At least we're not going to be surprised on it. But I think, and we're not there yet, but there will be either an act or a critical mass that all of a sudden will be the tipping point where people are going to go, how did China all of a sudden become a global navy? How'd that happen? Where that intellectual singularity come from, I don't know. I think inside our navalist mindset, I think most people intellectually have gotten it, but we're kind of a closed shop. I don't think the body politic are the people who believe their job is to keep the American public informed have really prepared us for that eventuality. But barring any type of internal disintegration in China that I wouldn't bet your money on, the Chinese will continue to learn, to grow, to deploy, to become more influential. Hopefully we can partner with them where our interests coincide. And in places they don't, hopefully we'll stand our ground, because if we step back, they'll be more than happy to step forward and take it. And I don't blame them. I do the same thing.
Yeah, I think that I noticed somebody else, it might have been Scott Brim in the chat room, noted that, you know, they're using this the anti-piracy exercises in the Indian Ocean to learn how to deploy their ships and to replenish at sea and to all that. Now they're going to establish a base in Djibouti right next to the U.S. base. You know, we just have to know that they're out there and they're doing this stuff. I recently read that they're looking at producing some carrier more similar to U.S. carrier than to the Russian Varig design, which has been my learned opinion, an absolute piece of junk, but it's a good place to learn, I guess, to train pilots to, you know, training carriers, sort of like the old Lex.
Yeah, exactly.
But it does raise, as long as we're talking about China, it does raise the issue of, you know, they've got a lot to worry about with Korea, too. And I think Claude raises this issue. You know, there was some discussion I saw that they might be concerned enough about refugees from North Korea, should the North Korean government fall, that they would move into preemptively into North Korea to gain control of the North Korean and Chinese borders to make sure that didn't happen. Is that, in your view, a logical scenario for them?
What, that they're growing concern about North Korean refugees if anything goes south there?
No, that the North Korean refugees would come into China to get away from their own, you know, the abysmal government they already have. But if the GATT government fell, will there be a you know, kind of like the when the wall falls and all the East Germans move west?
Well, I know that the Chinese are a little self-conscious already about their minority ethnic Koreans on the border there. And I think that's also one thing that we don't fully appreciate is the ethnic differences in that part of the world. I had an interesting conversation in Charleston a few weeks ago with a lady roughly my age. Her father, European extraction. Her mother was from Korea. And she got one of those 23andMe DNA tests. It came back that actually she's not half Korean, she's one quarter Korean, and she's one quarter Japanese, which created quite the crisis in her maternal family, and she's not allowed to tell anybody else in the family that. But the Chinese, the Han Chinese especially, are very sensitive about minorities. I think they would hold the border as much as they could to try to keep the Koreans in Korea, which means that it would be South Korea's problem one way or another. I don't see how with the security state that they have in North Korea, where they would have the type of civil disintegration like you would see in most other normal countries, mostly because, as they've proven, the North Koreans can allow millions of their own countrymen to die and still maintain power, and that is the new normal. Again, going back to you almost have to go back to the Dark Ages and the Middle Ages mentality to try to understand North Korea. European countries in the Middle Ages would routinely lose 15, 20, 25, 30% of their population due to either war or disease, and they would just keep plodding along just fine. I think with how that social structure is in North Korea, they could very well do the same. I think we should need to be careful not assuming that you would have a response inside North Korea that we would see in other normal or quasi-normal modern nations.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. As long as we're talking about that area of the world, again, let's talk a little bit about what Russia is up to. And in this case, there have been a lot of articles since December of last year about Russia cozying up to the Taliban, perhaps even providing them with weapons as part of, looks like, a continuation of the Great Game, which reminds me that you've often suggested that people read that Hopkirk book called The Great Game.
Now more than ever.
Now more than ever, yeah. What is Russia doing in Afghanistan? You got any idea?
It's funny, again, what it is of Claude asking all the questions today, but I think Claude asked a question earlier on we're in our seventh year of the show here. What do I think is our most prescient shows? I think it's back before Russia was back again, we were doing shows mostly with our friend Dmitry Gorenberg talking about Russia. One of the things I think we as a show were most prescient about is the fact that we never lost a focus on Russia. We could do a Bloody Russia show every month, but I think we're averaging about three a year, which is probably about right to get updates on Russia. But going back to Russia, and are they working with the Taliban or not, I'm reminded of a brief I sat in on almost a decade ago where we had a Ukrainian retired two-star, i.e. Soviet two-star, come and brief us after reviewing the releasable parts of the O plan we were working on in Afghanistan. Great about working in NATO is you can tell the former Warsaw Pact guy, because we had a translator up there because his English was so poor, but he would tell a joke in Russia and about 30% of the people in the room would laugh and the rest of us have to wait for the translation before we could laugh. So you knew who knew Russian and who didn't know Russian. But he said something that's always stuck with me, and I think I've mentioned it on Midrats before. He said, yep, your O plan, specifically talking about the Ring Road and some stuff we were doing for development, he said, is very similar to ours, he said, with the exception that we would mine hillsides, would bomb entire villages, and you're not doing that. And he, ha, 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 big laugh. But when you look at, especially recently, there's been some good translations of first-person accounts of Soviet soldiers and their experience at the tactical level, at least, in Afghanistan, very similar to what we're going through in many ways. Some of the battles, some of the villages, same thing. And I think the Russians see Afghanistan as another way to keep America occupied, keep her alliances a little shaky, a little insecure, with a little bit of possibility of blowback, but I think they're more interested in finding ways to keep us distracted and off balance. And I also would not immediately dismiss another base human instinct, which, how does it feel now? You supported the Taliban when we were there and we lost all these people. You gave them all these weapons. Well, you know what? If you don't like it, tough. We're going to do a little bit here too. Have a nice day. Oh, and by the way, yeah, we'll take some payments and some contracts to help keep the supplies going through Pakistan and Central Asia. I'm not sure if we're still using any of those Central Asian routes, but I think there's a little bit of that going on there. I just think it's another opportunity for them to bleed and distract and be a menace to us, and probably looking. In the long term, they're hedging their bets. What if the American-backed government in Afghanistan goes the way of Najibullah and the Soviet-backed government? Who's going to take power? Will they have friends or at least people they can keep in contact that are in power in Kabul if that government falls? And I wouldn't be shocked if that's what they're doing as well. Again, one of the things I would do if I was them. So I think that's what they're doing. Nothing more than irritating us and having a plan B to maintain contacts and potential business contacts in any type of government that would follow the fall of the present government.
Yeah, I put up an Al Jazeera article that discusses this, and it asserts that one of their goals is to, they think they can control the Taliban's drug dealing, and they trust the Taliban more than the current Afghan government. That's this article says, you know, I'm not sure that you can trust the Taliban to be the Taliban, I guess. And if you don't, you know, the Russians have a whole different view of human rights and stuff than we do. But, you know, I mean, this is just of a piece, I think, and you and I have discussed this before and had it on the show. And certainly the efforts that they're making in the Arctic, the efforts they're making in the Baltic and so many other areas. And as one of the people in the chat room says, gee, how about the GIUK gap and the new Russian submarines that are coming out? You know, it looks to me, I mean, we've talked before about how their population is not going to support the kinds of operation. We don't think, anyway, their aging population is a problem for the Russians. Is this just Putin being Putin, or, you know, is he really trying to get the Russian Empire back and or at least make them into if not what they used to be, a mini-me version of what they used to be?
I think so. I think that's part of what's driving it, especially a former KGB colonel who saw his entire world crash down around him, and with as little effort and risk as possible, if they have opportunities to type of nibble back the Soviet inheritance, which is really the Russian Empire's inheritance, I think they'll take it. I don't think he wants to go to war on it. I think he's very conscious of their limitations. But if he can get something cheap on the sly, he'll do it. Unlike Western nations, I really don't think he cares what The Hague says. I don't think he cares what Brussels says. I don't really think he cares what Strasbourg or Washington, D.C. or the U.N. really has to say. He can either ignore them, bluff them, threaten them, or bribe them to leave them alone. But he'll take what he can in little efficient bites as we go forward, because you look at the economics of it. There's just, and again, because I say this, that means that we'll be at war with them within a week. But they're in no position to have a major conflict anywhere. If you're on their border and you're strong, the old hedgehog porcupine theory, then you're going to be safe. I think the Poles know that, which is why Poland is rapidly increasing their defenses. The Estonians have always known this. The Latvians and the Lithuanians were late to the game, but they're slowly building up to Estonian levels of investment. The non-Russophile parts of Ukraine, if they can help get rid of their Russian levels of corruption, will continue to try to get closer to the West. I think there's going to be a growing partnership with Poland and Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, and again, it would be outside of NATO, to try to get strong. And one thing the Russians will do to undermine that is to work with some of the political systems in the West that can undermine that. There's been some evidence that the Russians have had some success in some of the former Warsaw Pact nations, Hungary, Slovenia, Slovakia, and a few other ones. They'll try to undermine, they'll try to create chaos. But if at least the frontline nations can reinforce their real strength, but also the strength of their civil society, that they've got nothing to worry about from the Russians. However, if they're weak, if they're unstable, and if they don't show resolve, the Russians will see it as an opportunity. And that's true for everybody on the Russian border. And they'll all have to come to terms with Russia as best befits them. but talk isn't going to get you there. Virtue signaling on an international level is not going to get there. You have to speak in what the Russians will understand, and that is strength and how much it would cost them to impinge on your sovereignty. You make that cost too high, they'll go someplace else.
Yeah, I think that's right. I find it hilarious. Some of the stuff on their cyber issues, you know, it reminds me of mine warfare. You know, how many mines do you need to close at harbor, you know? Well, you don't need any. You just need to tell people you mine the harbor. I worry that a lot of times that this election stuff, whether or not they actually hacked into various systems, we know that they're at least fooling around in the DNC stuff, but whether or not they got into anything else, what they've done brilliantly is create the potential for them having done something which allows other people to have doubts in their mind and to spread that as an attempt to legitimatize the current administration. And you know, that is troubling. And I believe they're doing that, and we've seen evidence of them doing that in other countries. So that is the concern. You know, not that they've laid mines everywhere, but the fact that they're announcing it, and then you get that little bit of doubt going on. One of the people early on in the chat room asked about why, you know, our carrier shortage, basically, that was identified, and we've talked about it a number of times here. And, you know, the alternatives to that, I think we've also discussed that in previous shows, but it is always worth raising, you know, why do we have nuclear carriers and that cost so much more than if we had a bunch of Kitty Hawk conventional carriers? And is there any point in even talking about conventional carriers anymore? Is that the only way to go nuke because of the longevity of the carrier platform and the ability of a nuke not to have to have a oil tanker train behind it across major oceans?
I think there's a couple of issues floating around here, and again, I would commend, and I think most of our listeners are already up to speed with it, I'd commend everybody to look up what Brian McGrath and Jerry Hendricks have done on the carrier debate. It's been a couple of years, but all those points are still valid. But I think part of the carrier issue folds into, you know, Paul also asked a question in the chat room earlier on about how do you man a 350-person Navy. And I don't know if we have so much a carrier shortfall as we have a money shortfall. These things are expensive. You get what you pay for. That's my take. We have to accept a few budget realities. You're only going to get so much money. And I think it's great that people are talking about a 350-ship Navy. I think it's a great point of order, a great discussion point. But I'll put on my comfort zone, which my economist hat. We have unsustainable levels of national debt in this country. And we need to look very seriously about not just the military budget, but the entire budget and how the military budget is connected to that national debt. In a classical sense, there's a thing called debasing the currency. Back when currency was actually real, it was gold or silver or maybe bronze coins. And when you look back at the history of Carthage, classic example, they continued to spend more and more money for their military going against Rome. And you can track that by how they debased their currency. And eventually they debased it to the point they couldn't even take care of their own military, much less buy off allies. And from an economic point of view, we've done a huge debasing of our currency since 2008, especially. Quantitative easing, however you want to buy it, call it. And if that wasn't playing on in the background, I would be a lot more excited about building back a really strong military. But in the context of the larger budget, what do you want to give up for that? Is the answer to write more IOUs for in the name of our children and grandchildren to do it. Sure, that's an option to do it. That's just the modern equivalent, though, of towards the end in Carthage, that you couldn't even have silver or even these silver gold coins anymore. Those were only used to pay off the mercenaries. You walked around with your pockets full of these huge bronze coins that were halfway worthless anyway. So we're going to have a carrier shortfall. We're probably going to have a Navy shortfall. We're probably going to have a military shortfall because we're not going to have the budgetary ability to support it anymore. If that's true, then maybe we don't have so much of a military budget shortfall as we have a security obligation overbought. And that's a hard thing to talk about, too. But if you're going to debase your national wealth to do a combination of bread and circuses at home and great fleets and armies abroad, that doesn't have a good track record down the road. Short answer, no, we can't afford to have as many carriers as we need.
Yeah, and I think also, though, that part of that carrier shortfall was caused by some temporary issues. The George H.W. Bush took longer in the yard period than it was supposed to, and that created a a log jam effect that caused some issues. And it was nice. I mean, it's nice to know that the French and pretty soon the Brits will be able to help. You know, I mean, the French came in and brought one of their carriers around and kind of filled that gap for a while. So it's good to have allies that have those capabilities, and we should encourage them all to spend that 2% of their GDP on things like big old aircraft carriers.
Yeah, and their aircraft carriers are actually – I totally blew off I went off on one of my tangents. Sorry about that, y'all. But they were asking about the nuke carriers, maybe smaller carriers. Well, you look at the Queen Elizabeth-class carrier the British are building now, and, of course, I always have had a weak spot for what's called the sea control ship, which the Spanish have built, and the Spanish built one for the Thais as well. Those smaller carriers, we also have the America-class, quote, amphibious, unquote, ship. I'm willing to entertain the argument. Is it better to have, you know, two super carriers or four or five smaller carriers if you want presence and still keep? I think that's a good argument to have. But you have some huge lobbies you've got to fight through if you want to do that. But I think that is a valid argument, and I'm open to both sides of it, really. You still with me, Gwen?
I keep pushing the wrong button. Yeah, I'm here. The OFF switch is fighting me hard today. With the F-35, if we ever get it to where it's supposed to be for the vertical and short takeoff and landing capability, the small deck carriers that we already have are probably adequate for the purpose we need them. If it's a presence mission and you don't need to have an entire carrier air wing, in fact, you could probably do it with helicopters and Ospreys if you really needed to. But we already have these ships. We don't need to keep building a brand new technology like that. But we do have to quit wasting money on things. And if the LCS, I hate to bring up the LCS, but if the LCS is gonna mount to something one of these days, we need to really get that going. So that is an important factor. Is are we going to cut what we've got and start building new? Is it time for us to stop this, not using, allow us to use foreign design ships and be a good NATO partner and all that stuff by buying foreign equipment? Okay.
Hey, I thought we had a caller there, area code 804. I see you, but he didn't answer me when I tried to talk to him. I just realized, wow, the hour's almost done. We're just chatty Cathy's, aren't we? Let's take a second, if we could, and let's talk about, kind of circle back to what the area we went to, which is the LACE administration. This is one thing that I have found interesting, and I'm not the first person to ask this. Where are the Navy's flag officers? When you look at both the retired and the active duty four-stars that have been brought into the new administration, it's very Marine Corps. Now, I know they're part of the Navy, but very Marine Corps and Army-centric. I don't see naval officers anywhere in this mix. And so I did a little bouncing in my head. It's like, okay, who are the high-profile four-stars that have retired recently or on active duty? And I think part of the reasons just might be that our Navy four-stars bet on the wrong horses. You look at Mullen and Roughhead. They were very, very much Democrat Party admirals for a variety of reasons. Admiral Stavridis, he was an advisor to the Hillary Clinton campaign, though I listened to him a few times during the course of the campaign. He still maintained his neutrality. He was not partisan. I'll give him a lot of credit for that. He was just somebody who was asked to advise and did. That's at least how I read it. And then you look at, and this is just my list, you may have different ones, and other people might as well, active duty, former Midrats guest, Admiral Bill Moran, now the vice CNO. I think he is very politically neutral, very experienced, but he's very much a keep the machinery, keep the very budget-focused. Very few people know the budget process better than he does. You have Admiral Harry Harris out west. In many ways, he's kind of the Navy's version of Jim Mattis when it comes to being a straight talker. I don't know if he would even want to do anything inside the new administration. And of course, you have the other high profile was Admiral Howard, who's now over in Europe. But again, she was clearly a very political admiral on the Democrat side of the House. Admiral Greenert, I don't know one way or another. He's just kind of faded away for reasons perhaps other people know better than I do. But I just don't think there's anybody Navy who is in a position to play.
Yeah, part of the problem is, and I was talking to some Navy ROTC midshipmen recently, part of the reason, and one of my sons, and part of the thing is that the Navy doesn't give our officers time off to go do things like get a PhD in international relations or whatever. You know, the minute you drop out of the glide path that you're supposed to be on for command and all that stuff, you become a lost cause. We've talked about this before too. A lost cause, as far as the Navy goes, no matter how much of a front runner you were before you left to go do things that should benefit the Navy. So I don't think we have we have people who are really smart, but we don't have people who are credentialed the same way as a lot of these Army guys and even the Marines, who very much are in many ways intellectually ahead of where the Navy officers are. I think that hurts us in many, many ways. But, you know, the Navy, for an officer, your job is to be the best Navy officer you can, and the rest of it is different. And that's changed considerably from 70 years ago when the Navy would take over a place like Guam and they would administer the place. It was just, that's just kind of the way it was. And I don't know how we get that back. I know we have those young officers from that Navy program on board. We've talked to Vice Admiral Moran about it, actually, because he was talking about how he had not had the chance to get that advanced degree. So,
yeah, I think you might be onto something there. And you know, it's been a regular topic that we've talked about here. And just to be inwardly focused for a moment, twice in my career, I looked at trying to do that while on active duty. One time a war got in the way, and the other time I was told in no certain terms that if I do that, nothing good will happen when I get out of school.
Yeah.
And so I was an intellectual coward, and I demurred from that. Go ahead.
I think it's somebody said, you know, it's one of the Navy checklists. They want you to have that master's degree, whatever, but you better do it on your own time.
Yeah, that's what I did.
And if you do it on your own time, if you do it on your own time, then you're a typically outstanding naval officer.
And even then, I took a hit for doing it on my own time because I had to say no to a collateral duty, believe it or not, and had to have a discussion with my boss about it. Hey, breaking news on Midrats. I want to thank a couple of my buddies over on Twitter for sending this to me. I keep my iPad with Twitter up while the show goes on. There have been some rumors about this, but Megan Eckstein and Sam Legrone about 20 minutes ago posted up on USNI News. Philip Bilden has withdrawn from the SECNAV nomination. And we just briefly have talked about him before on previous shows when he was put forward. He has one son who's at the Naval Academy now. One was a JO, living in Hong Kong for a while. But we now have the position for Secretary of the Navy is open and available now. Randy Forbes, call
well,
your
when,
office.
When do you want to move to Washington?
I would like to nominate Jerry Hendricks. I told him years ago, like, hey, Jerry, if you get a job, you know, if you need a duty driver, I know my way around the Beltway. but, hey, it's open. So this will be interesting to see. I was actually very, very interested in this choice because I thought it might give somebody to look at it with fresh eyes who hasn't been arguing with the same people for the last few years, somebody who is not a Beltway person, somebody with a business background, somebody that knows China and maybe could bring a fresh view, a fresh idea to China, or at least have somebody that can talk to the Chinese one-on-one. But with opening that up, maybe we'll fall back on some of the other people that are looking at. I think, you know, Randy Forbes is on everybody's short list, but I think it's going to be difficult to predict one way or another. One thing that I will say is I bet our good friend Secretary of Defense Mattis has a couple of people in mind that he may roll up to his boss. So maybe the new SECNAV might have a little bit of Mattis' stink on it. And that will be interesting to watch. But regardless of who it is, can we just get him nominated now? We need a Secretary of the Navy. You know, Stackley is doing fine as a stand-in job, but he's just keeping the plate spinning until the political appointee comes on board. I would really like to see a nominee sooner more than later, and I just hope he's good.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think, I'm sure there are all kinds of political ramifications, and those of us who don't live in the Beltway world and follow that quite as closely as other people all know what the intrigue was that went various ways. But anyway, you and I have spent over an hour talking here, so we could probably go on for a lot longer if we wanted to.
Well,
but,
that's why I put 90 minutes. As the folks that are live have noticed, and who don't say I never listen to anything that comes in on the chat room. Those that join us live every week have noticed that it doesn't automatically cut off at the 60-minute point. We still have a one-hour show, but because we're not too meticulous about it, I went ahead and put 90 minutes on there in case we stay a few minutes over, that the people who make the extra effort to be with us live don't get the information cut off. So we're still a one-hour show. But you're right, Eagle One, I think we may have overstayed our welcome a little bit. Thoroughly enjoyed the conversation here, and I thank for the we got at least half of our questions from the chat room. So thank you very much to the usual suspects, and we'll be seeing you next time, I guess.
Yeah, it's been fun. It's always great to kick around things that we know nothing about and pretend like we do. So, and it's great, as you said, to have people in the chat room keep us on the straight and narrow. So, thanks to all the people who showed up.
Yes, thank you, everybody, and keep an eye on us over at Twitter, over on our home blogs. And until then, we'll see you next on MidRats. Hope everybody has a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go, it's a long way to Tipperary. Tipperary, but my heart's right there.